Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Ducks Confidential Podcast. I am James Crepia, joined as always by Ryan Clark, and we'll be going over and reviewing the last week in Oregon athletics for men's and women's basketball, the baseball and softball teams getting rolling, and touch a little bit on the NFL Combine as that is getting underway in Indianapolis this week. Brandon Dorlus, as we are recording this on Thursday afternoon, Brandon Dorlus will be taking part in on-field drills quite literally as we are recording, so we may be able to read off a couple of his 40 times amidst all of this. But he's one of seven Ducks at the Combine this year. Kyrie Jackson also there. He did interviews earlier today. Evan Williams also on the defensive side. And, of course, on the offensive side, a lot of the headline makers there as well, with Bo Nix, obviously, Bucky Irving, Troy Franklin, and Jackson Powers Johnson. So a record number of Ducks in Indianapolis, and will certainly be capturing their on-field performances and a few blurbs of what they have to say to the reporters who are in Indianapolis at the Combine this year. But we start, Ryan, with the basketball programs, and we will touch on the men in a moment. But since we started with them last week, we'll start with the women this week. And obviously, as we've touched on before, we knew this season would not be a particularly good one, but the losing streak now reaching a program record tying 11 straight losses after the losses to the Washington schools to a very much rebuilding Washington team and a Washington State team that is still quite good on paper but lost its best player many weeks ago. So the Ducks now, again, as we're recording Thursday afternoon, prepare to host Cal this evening and then Stanford. I think we know how that one will go on Saturday in the regular season finale before heading to the Pac-12 tournament. The only thing left to determine is whether or not Oregon will finish in last place versus Arizona State for last place in the Pac-12. And of course, the future. But as the losing streak has extended, Ryan, what has been your impression? What has been some of your takeaways here more recently of even last week's games where, yes, were they more competitive? Yes, but they were supposed to be. Those are lesser opponents than the barrage of ranked opponents that they faced.
Right.
And obviously the results were still the same. So what was some of your takeaways and even the more recent games and how this team has been performing?
Yeah, I mean, 11 in a row is 11 in a row, right? It doesn't really get much lower, and it hasn't in program history lower than that. I mean, you touched on it. Like, if they lose tonight against Cal, that's the record. And that's a tough blemish on what has been a really overall strong tenure for Kelly Graves and company. So, you know, they obviously don't want that to happen. I think Cal tonight, we're recording this podcast, as you said, on Thursday afternoon. Cal tonight is that opportunity for them to get off of that streak, because if they don't win tonight, there is a juggernaut coming in on Saturday in Tara Vanderveer's Cardinal. But these last few games, I mean, it's been competitive those last two games. You expect it to be competitive against those teams. Washington, as you said, are rebuilding. Washington State lost its best player, but probably good chance they get in the tournament based on their overall resume. Good regardless of opponent that they were competitive. The problem of the matter is that level of competitiveness never quite seemed like, oh, like they've got a real good chance of winning this game, right? It was pretty. It's the stretches of incompetence and the stretches of just sheer struggle that this team goes through. It often seems like they're playing with one hand tied behind their back at times, with the lack of shooting ability on the outside that's consistent for them. Now that's improved in recent games, but before that it was pretty dismal from the outside. Phyllis Pinochet is racking up the points and rebounds. She's somebody that's been obviously a bright spot by both attrition and by the fact that she's really come into her own as a solid starting center at the collegiate level. She's a 20 and 10 for them, or close to it, pretty much night in and night out at this point in the season, because they don't really have anywhere else to go for offensive production right now, at least on a consistent basis. I mean, you look at that Washington State game, you know, you're competitive with a team that is on paper better than you, but you need more out of different role players. And I thought that that Van Sluten was strong, but other than her and then a couple of good games in a row from Kennedy Basham, the guard spot hasn't produced on the level that I think the Ducks need. Chance Gray was, I think, like 2 of 15 or 2 of 16 in that Washington State game. That's not going to cut it for somebody that, you know, they rely on pretty heavily to get up some shots, especially from outside. So a lot of layers to their struggles. Obviously, the talent gap is evident with the rest of what is a really strong Pac-12 conference this year. I don't think this is a team that has necessarily given up or is sort of mailing it in as the season goes down the stretch. I just think that the hill is just a bit too steep to climb for them. And so the question will be, can they get off this win streak with two games to, or losing streak with two games to go?
Yeah, again, we've touched on briefly before, but so many of the analytics, so many, you know, you could look at basic statistics, and then you could look at deeper analytics to really illustrate and understand exactly how poor this season has been, whether it be individually or collectively. Again, the lack of depth, you know, speaks to why, obviously, their bench scoring is virtually non-existent. And that's not being hyperbolic. Their bench points per game is not only last in the Pac-12. And again, remember, Arizona State still plays in this league, for another, you know, month or so, as far as the basketball teams are concerned. They're 340th nationally out of 349 teams in bench scoring. So that's, you know, it doesn't get much lower, to say the least, in that particular category. That's easy enough to understand. Steals. Again, for a team that entered the season talking about how they're going to be scrappy, gritty, and really be known for their defense, we've talked all year, they don't foul, so they don't play as the old Arizona State teams did, in particular. And I'm not saying that was a particularly appealing brand of basketball, but you knew that when you were playing them, you were in for a fight. You were in for a really tough defensive kind of a game, because that was the way they were going to play. Oregon, they sit in zone all night. So they don't force any turnovers. They're literally 348th and only ahead of Arizona State in the entire country in turnovers forced, because they sit in zone, in part because they don't have the depth to play man, and in part because some of the players, when they're playing in zone, and that's what stood out the last time they were at home, albeit against better opponents, some of the players were getting blown right by when they were, you know, particularly on the wings, on the defensive end, or not, you know, getting for loose balls on the defensive end and that stuff, where that's the part that stands out, where you go like, all right, want to sit in a zone is one thing. You don't want to force turnovers is one thing. You don't want to, you name it. But when, in particular, certain players on the wings, you know, defensively, in zone are just getting, like I say, just getting blown right by.
Yeah, it can't be a soft zone. It has to be reactive, and you have to use the athleticism that you have. I think, you know, players like Chance Gray that have that athleticism can function well in such a defensive system. The problem is the unit, the collective unit, and whether this is an issue of, you know, tactics or effort, it varies based on the moment, but they are just not reactive, and they have allowed so many open jump shots to teams that they should not have allowed them to. Let teams get back into games when they've had solid enough leads and gotten themselves into pretty deep holes against against much better teams as a result of that. They're just not reactive. And if you're going to play zone, like you gotta move as one, as coaches like to say, as an old basketball coach cliche, right? Like, you can't just have three people doing their job and then a couple of them are like a step or two slow.
Yeah, and that's the point. It's like, if one person gets beat in particular, like we're talking about on the defensive side, the help side and other defenders aren't exactly moving collectively in that sense. So that's where many of their struggles are on that end of the court. So even though it may look like, well, statistically scoring defense may not be all that bad. You know, well, for one, it kind of is. For one, I mean, they are 11th in the league and 235th nationally. So let's not make that out to be some resounding success, albeit against, yes, a very tough league. But when you get into, as I say, the advanced statistics for this team, and that's where some of it, particularly in league play, is so, so alarming, so extreme, so unfathomable. That's where you really have to ask some you really have to pose questions like, what is going on? What was the plan? Because particularly when we're talking about defense, conference opponents with two games to go, and you know, again, Stanford being one of them. So no matter what they do with Cal, win, lose, or how the performance looks, conference opponents have assists on 72% of their baskets. I mean, that's hard to do on air. That is off the charts. That is the most in the 15 years of the Her Hoop Stats database. That is the most that Oregon's allowed. And I would suggest that might be one of the highest numbers allowed by a major collegiate program at all in the prior 15 years. I mean, that is hard to do, particularly in league play, where, you know, you're supposed to know what the other team is doing. No, I don't care if you're playing zone man or anything. That is just so extreme, so off the charts. In case in point, you know, one of the higher numbers Oregon had allowed was last season at 62%. And that was high. To have assists, opponents have assists on 72% of their baskets is, as I said, that's it borders on unfathomable.
Yeah, it suggests a lot of very easy looks, right? And yes, whether it's from inside or outside. And so that,
but easy, yeah, looks that aren't coming on the fast break. That, yeah. Basically, what that tells you is that only 28% of baskets are coming with one player going coast to coast or fast break or doing it solo. Everybody is getting extreme ball movement and ease of passes and passing lanes and finishing. So it's not just that the passes are there, it's that they're also obviously converting on them. And that's the point where you go like, all right, I don't care what defense you're playing. That is so off the charts, combined with, oh yeah, a turnover rate that is barely happening at all. So opponents are, you know, assisting on 72% of their baskets, and they're only turning it over, again, conference opponents are talking about, less than 11% of their possessions. And Oregon is turning it over at an extreme on offense. So if your assist to turnover ratio on offense is abysmal, and their assist to turnover ratio in conference play is 2.4. I mean, you want to talk about recipes for not being able to win games? This is it.
Yeah.
You're allowing opponents to have free reign and free will to pass and move and shoot without really very much of a challenge at all. And on offense, you're just giving it away.
Yeah.
And not converting, particularly from the outside, where they've actually, credit to them, the last couple of games, which stood out to me, was they're not even attempting shots on the outside. But how can you critique them? They're not shooting well. So if it's, you know, what's the definition of insanity? Keep doing, it's not working. So, okay. So they've gone inside at times with some moderate success. But obviously outside has been a challenge. It's been a challenge all year, like you touched on. And if Chance Gray's not knocking them down, there's basically nobody else who's even attempting threes. And okay. But if you're giving up, if you're giving up when you're giving up and you're going from the 2-point and the free throw line, the recipe for success this season has been, as we've touched on, virtually impossible. And that's where they find themselves.
Yeah. And you know, this is part of the larger conversation about where the program stands going into the future. And look, I mean, these last two games are what they are. Try to get off the losing streak. Your season's going to end in a couple of weeks. That's just going to be what it is for this Oregon team this year. The question then will be, you know, if Kelly Graves is retained, what does his staff do to sort of retool this program in a way that allows them to compete next season? Obviously, that includes, as we said on the last podcast, work in the transfer portal, the recruiting trail. Those are obviously the two big areas that they need desperately, because they need more bodies. They need more players that are, you know, collegiate level contributors and stars and people that can carry you on both ends. And they're was one piece of news this week from the program getting a five-star guard, Jania Williams, for class of 2025. Obviously, she's not going to be here for a while. She won't be here next year, obviously. But, you know, work in the class of 24 and, you know, work on the trail for, you know, NIL and offering that to different players and trying to tout the successes your program has had and build the brand back in a way that allows you to succeed. Because right now, like, what they're doing currently simply is just not cutting it. Last place in the league is not something that Kelly Graves aspires to, and is not representative, I think, of what's happened over the last decade in this program.
No, and they do get Peyton Scott back, that being the other bit of news for the week, and that she announces, as was expected. So, yes, it was formally announced, we should say, really.
But right.
From the time she was injured and, you know, literally 5 minutes into the season, the expectation was that she would seek a medical hardship waiver to play the additional year and then be able to return for a 6th year. So that was formally announced earlier this week. But again, we... ever since November, that had been the working assumption, because basically, why wouldn't you? Why in the world would you not? So, yes, he gets to come back. But in terms of, you know, on paper, does it look like they have, most of the roster, particularly most of the contributors, slated to come back? Yeah, and of course, as soon as the season's over, we're not just talking regular season or Pac-12 tournament, because while you can think of it whatever you want to think of it, there is still the opportunity to play in one of the postseason tournaments. Whether or not you choose to pay attention to it or not, that's up to you as a fan. We're not here to tell you one way or the other. If they play, they play. Whatever the tournament is, whatever the opportunity is, for however long it may or may not be. But once the season is completely over, obviously, all players everywhere have decisions to make regarding their future, so we're not going to start openly speculating about who's going, coming, or otherwise. On paper, do they have most of their roster with eligibility remaining and the opportunity to return? Yes. And they have two signees, Katie Fiso being one of them. So when you have a Peyton Scott, who is supposed to be your 30-plus minute a night point guard, and Fiso, who's going to be, well, originally you thought Scott was going to be just the one-year player and then Fiso would take over. Now you might be able to pair them together. Chance plays more of a true two and not have to, you know, rely on her to be the ball-heavy point guard next year. Sure. But again, lots of decisions to make across the board for the program, top-down. So we're not going to get into every single player and what they're going to do. There's plenty of time to get into all that. For now, it's wrapping up. It's seeing what can they snap the losing streak, whether they do or they don't. But this team looks like, like you touched on, Ryan, to wrap it up on them, and as we shift to the men, this team has not completely mailed it in at all. Now, again, you can critique certain things by way of defensive effort or fighting for loose balls or getting out hustle. Yes, there are things to critique for sure. But last weekend, when the losing streak was 9 games, had they gone to Washington and Washington State and gotten their doors blown off, that's where you start asking questions about in a far greater way. They were competitive, and that you don't get a prize for that. There's no silver linings for that sort of thing. But the point is that they were still trying to win these games, and we'll see obviously what happens this evening with the game against Cal. But had they gone into games where they're quote unquote supposed to be more competitive, and gotten just shellacked, then you say, okay, then this team has really given up. Credit to the players insofar as it is hard to keep a particular upbeat mindset when you are losing that much. I mean, Kelly Graves even said earlier this week, he described everybody as a bit shell-shocked because, I mean, look, it is what it is. You've lost 11 straight games. Now, that said, for the players who were part of last year's team, you know, they had an awfully long losing streak last year toward the end of the regular season as well. So, again, it's been a tough year. No matter what happens this weekend or in the Pac-12 tournament, it will continue to be a tough year. So we'll obviously chronicle the last few games that remain and also begin to, as we already have, address what it looks like heading into the future. But for the men, Ryan, part of why we're doing the podcast on Thursday this week, because they were playing late into last evening with a fine 8 o'clock local start.
Yeah, I heard about some pretty sketchy drives up I-5 for some of the folks that hail from the Portland area, Sean Maker among them, who were facing down a river, basically, coming up late last night. So.
Yeah, I'm sure it had to be a fun excursion for those who made the voyage. But be that as it may, one of the few games on the schedule every year that no matter what the records, case in point last night, no matter what the records, Oregon and Oregon State generates some attention for obviously for our audience and for everybody who's a fan of either way in this state. And also, last night's game, first off, I thought as a game, as start to finish, as an entire game, was absolutely better than the one, earlier in the month in Corvallis, where, yes, the finish was, you know, rather entertaining, but the game itself for about 35 minutes was not, to be quite honest. Last night's game was competitive all the way through. Yes, Oregon pulls away a little bit late and makes it more comfortable and easier than it had been. But for a series that obviously is now about to shift into kind of a different world, and I say about to, but it's also entirely possible that these teams meet again in the Pac-12 tournament. If Oregon can manage to finish in the top four and get that and all that, it's entirely possible they avoid playing Oregon State again. But depending on how Oregon finishes, it could be the 5-12 matchup again in the Pac-12 tournament. So I say it's possible. We will obviously discuss that if it occurs. But these two teams, for a series that Oregon has dominated the last couple of seasons and has now won 7 in a row, the longest win streak by either team in this series, the most contested series in college basketball in the country, the longest win streak in 20 years by either side since 99-03, and a 9-game win streak for Oregon then. It actually took 19 of 20 at the time. A 7-game win streak, for as dominant as it's been, you've had 3 last-minute, one-possession wins in Corvallis as part of that, and a win last night that turns out 78-71, and yes, they pulled away a little bit late again the last couple of minutes. Last 10 really taken over by Jermaine Cousinard and Kwame Evans Jr., who had by far the best game of his season in doing so. But that said, on the other side, look, you have to say the Beavers are shorthanded as well by way of depth of talent. But Tyler Bilodeau and Jordan Pope made some crazy shots, some contested shots where, particularly in the first half, I mean, Pope really put on a show and made it extremely difficult for the Ducks there. And Bilodeau, again, played really well as well. They both had 20-point games, both played well. These two teams have an ability to bring out simultaneously the best and worst in each other at times in the same game. Because at the start of each half and at the start of the first half at Corvallis, the offense was a-flowing. Points were just raining down for both teams. Neither one of them could really miss much by way of anything. And then at the same time, they could go through stretches where, you know, my goodness, particularly as Oregon State finished, holy smokes, you know, a brutal finish of 5-19 to finish a game that they – and not to say that they had command of, when you have a game that was played within 6 points for 90%+ of it. Entertaining, amusing, at the same time, for Oregon's purposes, in the big picture, you're talking about a quadrant four home win, so they quite literally dropped the spot in the net as a result. So you don't want to make less of it than it is, because it is a rivalry and it means a lot to people in the state and the programs and the teams and et cetera. However, in the big picture, let's call it what it is. If this were against a team one spot ahead or behind of Oregon State in the net rankings, and Oregon was playing them in December in a non-conference game, you would pay it very little mind at all.
Yeah, it's a box to check. It's something they just needed to do down the stretch with obviously bigger games ahead, including the next one.
Yes, in particular. And that's the grand irony being that, yeah, that the way that the schedule fell this year, that yes, that Oregon has the midweek game with Oregon State and now a trip to Tucson and against the top team in the league. Whether Arizona wins the league or Washington State wins the league, Arizona's the best team in the league.
Yeah.
I mean, let's call it what it is.
And last Pac-12 trip to McHale, too.
Yeah, and that's part of it that, look, for all of the Pac-12 opponents, Oregon State included, that and both coaches have said they're going to continue the series as to where where the game will be played next year. Obviously, I'm sure they both want it at home. Do I think Oregon has probably a little bit of an advantage to probably getting it at home? Yeah, probably. But it'll rotate. It's not like it's going to be exclusively at Matthew Knight or exclusively at Gill, for that matter. It'll go back and forth. It'll be earlier in the year, but so what? You know, I mean, frankly, I think there's a way to do it whereby depending on who hosts the football game, and I realize the football game gets moved up dramatically and people can feel one way or the other, but it gets moved up from obviously after Thanksgiving to September. But I think there's a way to do it whereby whoever hosts the football game that year, that the other team could host the basketball game that year, and you could do the basketball game either the day before or the day after or on the weekend of, or depending on how the final weekend of the regular season goes for football. Yes, it's against different teams, so it wouldn't be quite the same way as it could have, would have, should have been. But I think there's a way to do it whereby that could get done. But again, we'll obviously discuss the scheduling and stuff for the future when we get there. But a series that, like I say, has been dominated by the Ducks over the last couple of years, and yet there's been these really competitive games. Again, three of them in Corvallis, but last night being another one where, I mean, Oregon State led, you know, a huge chunk of the game. And again, got some really good performances there. But, you know, without making nothing of it, because, again, it does matter to people in the state very much. And you had quite a showing of people and alums and former players, both football and basketball, at the game last night at Matthew Knight Arena between first off, yes, Dan Lanning has put in some time at the arena himself, but you had Mari Loon was there, Tony Graziani was there, Joey Harrington was there. Look, you know, great, nice to see former players putting in some time, but again, for a midweek, 8 o'clock and the rest. But yeah, you know, it was 8,000 plus people in the building for a team, you know, for a game that, again, if we're against somebody that wasn't Oregon State, but had similar ranking or similar standing, you know, you would not get that kind of showing. So, yes, it does matter. Yes, there are people who are showing up simply because it is the rivalry and the like. And I thought got a really entertaining basketball game out of it.
Yeah.
And at times, really well played at times. Again, also at times where some of the shooting was pretty brutal. but for the lion's share of the night, and certainly in the entirety of the box score, that became more of almost the outlier. Compared to how Oregon had been shooting in a couple of prior games. Now, again, the three-point shooting was still not great. It wasn't. But in terms of how they finished in particular, Cousinard and Evans specifically, I thought how Evans played on the whole, particularly when he's coming off an ankle injury that had knocked him out for basically almost the entirety of the second half at Cal, for him to turn around and not just have a really good performance, but a performance in how it looked in finishing, facing the hoop with the power and authority that he did. Hey, this is part of what being a freshman is. Sometimes, yes, it does take 20 plus games for all the lights to go on, for the development to happen. But for all of those who want to be not just nitpicking, but almost hypercritical of Dana Altman and his staff because, oh, it could be a third year straight in the NIT and that's not the expectation. Well, first off, you know, Dana set the expectation. For one. Two, they're winning 20 games in these years where they're still going to the NIT. And we'll see whether or not they end up there or not. We'll see. It's not quite determined just yet. And what? Is it because of lack of recruiting? Now, this year, it's been a team ravaged by injury.
Yeah.
Ravaged by injury. And they're still going to end up potentially at 20 plus wins, potentially with a top four finish in the league, and who knows what happens in the conference tournament.
Yeah, and then the whole landscape changes next year anyway when they move to the Big Ten and have all these other teams to play, and their whole the whole axis of their resume as it stands, as it will stand, is going to shift. So yeah, it's like, you know, I think that, you know, yeah, it's disappointing, and I'm sure Dana's disappointed that, you know, it would be, if it is that, a third straight year in the NIT. But at the same time, I think given the you know, strength of the conference in some of those years, and given the bad luck this year with injury, yeah, I don't think it's anything to sort of discount or look down on, even if it might be disappointing.
I think at times it's easy to fly off the handle about the very base result and say, again, under the presumption that it is an NIT-bound team. And I say a presumption not because I think there's an at-large possibility. I do not, as I've said for weeks. The math ain't mathing. It's not there. Opportunities and the opportunities for quality wins are simply not there to have this team raise its profile enough. I still think the only path to the NCAA tournament is to win the Pac-12 tournament. And obviously the path to make that easier is to start with a top four finish and avoid having to play four games in 4 days. And hopefully for Oregon's purposes, avoid playing Arizona until the conference tournament finals. Not that potentially playing Washington State becomes a terribly easy task, sure, but at least you split with them.
Do you think this game then Saturday is sort of their bellwether? Like, oh, can we hang with, compete with, and maybe even beat a team like Arizona, just given the fact that that's going to be the dragon you got to slay in a couple of weeks anyway? So, you know, is this the big sort of tester for them, given that their health is sort of where it's going to be?
Not getting anybody back at this point. Yeah, this is who they got.
Yeah. So do you think that then? Is this maybe their feeling about that game?
I think there's tones that can definitely be set from regardless of what the outcome is. Because look, if they go into McHale and won, or just not just competitive in the sense that, like, if they lost by 12 but it was close. No. I mean, if it's a one or two score game, if it goes down to the wire, one way or the other, if it win, hey, what a feather in the cap, and it's obviously the best win of the season. And, you know, that then you'll start getting, you know, the those who are still holding out the morsel of hope and will completely lose their minds over whatever bracketologist says they moved up four spots or something, without projecting as to what the next week has in store, but whatever. But even in a loss, if it were to be close, if they were to contain Caleb Love and not have him go off as he did the first time around, which took all of the air out of the building immediately in the earlier meeting of the season. If they were to achieve certain things, even in defeat, as long as they, again, were still able to finish in a top four position and put themselves in position to play Arizona again, whether it be in a semifinal or tournament final if they got there, I think you can take something from a performance, even in defeat, against a team like that. If you're able to achieve something, if you're able to really say, like, all right, well, yeah, it obviously stinks to lose, but you were able to contain their best player and really put him in a bind, if you can. Compared to, like, frankly, you may get an incredible win, but if Caleb Love goes off for, you know, 28 points and you win by two, yeah, you win by two, but in a rematch, you're going to go like, yeah, but you've had a hard time containing when, you know, one of the best players in the league has gone absolutely bananas,
right,
each time you've played him. So I think there are things that you could take positively, win or lose, from the trip to Tucson. But obviously, yes, winning it, would it be significant? Would it carry an incredible amount of weight in terms of a potential rematch and how they feel about things? At that point, what would be about 2 weeks later in the conference tournament? Sure. But cart before the horse, there's still obviously the two games thereafter against the Mountain Schools, which Colorado slides up for the moment. It appears to be a quadrant one home game. And I say appears because they're 29th. And the cutoff in the net rankings is top 30. So they've been on the cusp of quadrant one or quadrant two in terms of Oregon's resume, well, not just Oregon's resume, but we're focused on Oregon's resume, everyone's resume, as what would be a quadrant one home game against a top 30 team, they're right there on the cusp of it. Will it be, won't it be, to be determined. Ultimately, Arizona, for as big as it is, does it carry weight and significance? Yes. Win or lose, will the Colorado game, one way or the other, probably be more significant? Not just because of whatever Colorado and it, you know, wherever it falls on a net resume, but because of the conference standings. Because again, no matter what they do against Arizona, Colorado's still right there with them, one game behind in the standings. And they play Stanford, where, yes, Oregon has Arizona on Saturday. Colorado's got Stanford on Sunday. So if you were to go by chalk here and Oregon loses and Colorado wins, then they are both sitting at 11-7 entering next week's game, where the winner will almost undoubtedly have the leg up, particularly since Colorado already had the win earlier in the year. If Colorado wins it, Oregon can't catch them, and then the ceiling is fourth. That's, to me, the more significant game, regardless of what Oregon does or doesn't do against Arizona. The Colorado matchup, because of the implications for the top four, the race for the top four, is really significant. And obviously UCLA losing to USC had a factor there. We got a game tonight with UCLA and Washington, where for Oregon's purposes, for the race for the top four, Oregon will want Washington to win that game. That would be rather advantageous for the Ducks, if anything that can basically help their top four purposes. This is no longer about at large and resumes and those sorts of things, and what the ripple effects are in quadrant two, three, and the like. This is just about
positioning,
getting to the top four and positioning. So that's where I say I think the Colorado matchup is bigger because of the implications, particularly where, again, win or lose against Arizona, if Arizona does win the league, the difference between three and four could be significant, and whether you have to play them in the semifinal versus the final. And again, I'm not looking past the potential matchup with Wazoo and thinking that that's easy. It's not. One way or the other, you're going to have to go through, in all likelihood, two teams who are bound for the, two ranked teams, two teams who are bound for the tournament. One way or the other, you're going to have to beat them both to win the conference tournament, to win the auto bid. So the mission's not easy, but what is the quote unquote easier path? Probably playing Washington State first. just going with this. Because if you're the four and you play Arizona first and somehow, some way you beat them, congratulations, on less than 24 hours, then you probably have to play Washington State and beat them. That's no picnic. That's not a lot of fun after you just probably had to go completely bananas and had to play
of build it up in terms of the intensity, right? Because you're going to be as intense probably with Wazoo as you might be with Arizona, but it's a different animal, right? It's,
and who had to play who in the semifinal before that, when you get to the final big, and that's all stuff that we'll obviously touch on next week, and setting up for the Mountain Schools matchups and the like, and obviously we'll go over whatever they do in Arizona and the like. As we put a bow on this week's edition of the podcast, wanted to touch a little bit more on baseball and softball, as we made a cursory mention of them last week. We'll certainly get more into them as their seasons go on. But baseball, not a lot to get into by way of every which thing just yet, because, look, they had their home opening series, which they dominated as expected.
Yeah, so that was a fun one.
Off this, I mean, they played a team that came in here to do exactly what occurred. That will probably be the worst team that Oregon plays all year in Lafayette. So be it. Now they get UC Santa Barbara this weekend for the second straight year. A series that was supposed to be played in Southern California gets moved due to weather down there. And then unfortunate irony being that the weather in Eugene is not expected to be particularly good either. But be that all as it may, Oregon gets a three-game series to Santa Barbara coming up, and then follows with a trip to Arizona to play both Grand Canyon and then ASU to start league play only a week later. So, again, it really jumps right into league play pretty quickly here now that the conference tournaments are part of the equation. But a nice start for the Ducks. baseball wise, are we going to get into every which statistic yet? No, because especially there's nothing 0.0 to read off of any one individual performance from last weekend by way of statistics, because I mean, come on now. But having said that, pitching wise, where there were a lot of questions because there were questions based off injury last year, and then they had a lot of guys to replace, and particularly out of the bullpen and other things. Hey, between starters who've done pretty nicely so far, some of whom have done really, really nicely so far, and a couple of guys out of the bullpen who've, again, you don't want to, you know, get too crazy just yet, but some nice performances, some really powerful pitchers, some good strikeout numbers, good velocity. So there's been, without getting too hyperbolic here, it's still a wee bit early for any of that. But there have been some new names to the roster who have stood out, particularly in the pitching realm. But yes, and not taking anything away from the offense, but I don't want to make more of the offense because they were just playing Lafayette. So let's keep it in a degree of perspective. But whether it's Brock Moore or Cole Stokes, or again, some new names in the bullpen in particular, who I thought did rather well last weekend for the baseball side of things, whereas it's softball, who also a tournament hosts and has their home opener as we're recording here, weather permitting, on a tough weekend, a weekend that loses a little bit of juice with Florida State not making the trip, understandably, because of the weather forecast. They were trying to fit in two doubleheaders on back-to-back days, and yeah, if you're going to travel that far,
that's a long way to go to not play. Yeah,
yeah. That, again, it would have been chaotic, where assuming even any game would have gotten in, or maybe multiple games gotten in, but if you had all kinds of weather delays, what that does, and you got flights and all these things that get very, very complicated logistically. So unfortunately, a weekend that loses a little bit of juice because of that. But nevertheless, some games with Mount St. Mary's, Maryland, in particular, on tap for Oregon softball, and a season so far that's gotten off to a difficult start at 9-7, because so far their situational hitting, it's been their offense has been the issue. Pitching wise, not to say they've been flawless, but they've been quite strong. Even in losses, they've been quite strong. It's that hitting wise, in their losses, their situational hitting has been brutal. Getting on base has been far less the issue. The issue has been two out hitting, runner in scoring position hitting. That has been this team's bugaboo so far. And well, on one hand, here we are in February 29th talking about whether or not the team's hitting well or not. Yeah, but 16 games into a softball season is actually a significant chunk of a season. I realize once you get into league play in the very, very near future, weekends start getting down to three-game series again. But 16 games is a good chunk of games, even if it's only a couple of weekends. That's a significant portion of the non-conference play, and against some of the better teams, some of whom are quite comparable to the Pac-12 teams that Oregon's going to be facing, including right out of the chute with Cal and Utah. That's got to be a little bit concerning, yes, that some of the situational hitting has just not been there. And it's not a matter of one player or two players. This has been virtually across the board. It was going to be tough for Oregon, not just tough, really tough, to replace two All-Americans in Allie Bunker and Tara McGowan offensively, or in the field, for that matter. In the field, they've done so far better, and that's still one of the great strengths of the team under the missing Lombardi. Their defense is fantastic, but their situational hitting has been, it's been poor to start off.
Yeah,
there's no other way around.
And they've
it.
Really been, dropped in the rankings pretty precipitously too. That's inevitable. But yeah,
when 9-7 and you lose the games that they've lost, yeah, and they've dropped from being a top 15 team in the preseason polls to being, 25 in one and 26, unranked in the other. Not great. And that's the difference. It's a sport where at the very elite level, there is not a lot of margin for error. The games are decided at times on basically two plays. That's about it. At the absolute highest of levels of college softball, pitching is dominant and one or two hits decides the whole thing. And one or two hits a game, five or six or seven times over, that's been the difference. So on one hand, you could say, well, if you had five or six more hits, they could be, well, yeah, they could, but they're not. And on one hand, is it a little too early to raise all kinds of alarms? Yeah, probably. On the other hand, again, 16 games is not an insignificant number by way of non-conference play. And with the caliber of opponents they have to play remaining, particularly once conference play begins very shortly, how alarming those results can and should be will be readily evident. And that's where, as I say, like, on one hand, do they have some players doing really well offensively? Kai Luchar in particular, a leadoff batter who, you know, she surged in once she got healthy last year. She's hitting 500. She's doing remarkable. That's why I say getting on base is not the problem. She's fantastic. She's one of, not just one of the best leadoff hitters probably in the conference, she's probably one of the best leadoff hitters in the country and an incredible fielder. Her speed is remarkable. She will be, I mean, forget about hitting 500 all year, but no matter what she hits all year, she'll probably be not just an all-conference candidate, could be an all-American candidate from that perspective. There are things positive for the offense, yes, but it's you got to get her in. You know, she's going to get on base a lot, but you got to get any number of runs in, and that's been this team's struggle so far. So we'll see how this weekend goes for them. One, hope that they get as many games in as possible, and we'll touch more on the spring sports in the weeks ahead as, again, they shift into conference play very, very soon for both baseball and softball. So we'll get into that more. And we'll spread up spring football here in the probably next week, quite frankly, because we got the announcement today that Oregon will be opening spring practice in just a matter of a couple of weeks, a couple of practices before spring break. So the Ducks will open spring practice on March 14th and hold the second on the 16th. So T-shirt time, T-shirt days will be on the 16th, on the 14th and 16th. Then they'll have the two-week hiatus for winter finals and spring break and come back and resume on April the 2nd. So, but we will set up and wrap up everything in terms of the women's basketball season and heading into the tournament, setting up for the end of the men's basketball season, and begin to, yes, lay the groundwork for spring practice and remind everybody, you know, of all the personnel movement and the like, and set up for what that will look like once spring practice begins. But we'll get into that a little bit next week and again the following week for once spring practice really does get here. But for this edition of the podcast, we appreciate it. We thank you and remind you, make sure to subscribe to the Oregonian Sports Podcast. Give us a like, a follow, a five-star review, all those fine and fun things. So that way you can hear each and every edition of Ducks Confidential and all of the other fine programs on the Oregonian Sports Podcast to get all of your coverage of all things Oregon sports, not just Ducks, whether that be Beavers, Blazers, high school sports, and all the like, and all the work of our fine colleagues as well. So for Brian Clark, I am James Crepia, and we will see you next week.